We just did possession. The other title of this subsection is loss of soul. Just trying to sum up those two pages, 30 and 31. Basically, when you project, you're in danger of loss of soul. Because the interest and the talent or the personal attribute that you possess isn't available to you since you see it outside yourself. But again, that makes it sound negative, and the positive aspect of that can be that it was time to have a loss of soul. It was time to lose interest in the present state of your life, because that state of your life needs to change. So that the loss of soul is a period of disorientation in which you're seeking a new way to live, a new set of values, a new set of interests, maybe even a new set of friends. And when the loss of soul comes to an end, you'll be fired up with a whole new interest.
If it never comes to an end, what about people who chronically have loss of soul?
Well, then you're not looking at your projections, I'd say.
You chronically have loss of soul?
What was your question? Chronically depressed, right?
Oh.
Loss of soul and depression don't necessarily have to be the same thing. You know, there is some depression which is organic. But I think generally, if it's a psychological issue, then there's a value waiting to be understood. So if you're going through a loss of soul, which would be listless, no interest, blah, maybe depressed, but not necessarily. You know, can't quite find anything that's satisfying or satisfactory. You know, the half-empty way of putting it is, well, you've lost something, and the half-full way of putting it is, there's something waiting to be found.
It just be a state of anxiety.
Anxiety? Yeah. Generally, I think. I just saw a dream this week of a guy. Somebody stole my girlfriend. It wasn't his real girlfriend. And he's bored and irritable and likes one too many beers at night. And that's the loss of soul. And we got to find out who stole her and where she's going. And it feels like a malaise, and it is, but also maybe she wanted to be stolen. So that's how that stuff appears. So that's 30 and 31. I think the key feature in all of this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines up from the bottom of 30, and an intense new interest in life emerges. An interest that now serves in a direction different from the previous one. So that shift of direction is what it's about.
So all the energy that you once put into specific aspects of your life, then gets kind of imploded in,
right,
in a way, mm-hmm, and reorganizes around a new interest or something new, and then bursts forth,
right,
if you can deal with it.
Right. Okay. Indeed. And then she talks about love being hit by an invading spirit. I think that's the main bit of that chapter. Okay, well, we'll look at that very last paragraph, but up to the last paragraph, are you okay? I'll read that last couple, his last couple of lines. On 34, go up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Page 34.
Usel, I guess his name is Jusel, but the J is pronounced like a Y in German. Usel, whoever he is, regards it as entirely self-evident that the evil spirits he successfully expelled from a young girl were not part of the girl's psyche. They're talking about exorcism. His essay comes immediately after a paper by the psychologist Wolf Bunnenberg, in which it is taken for granted with equal conviction that the demons are complexes, that is split off parts of the girl's own psyche, which have been repressed from consciousness. So one's saying what you're possessed by is a real spirit, the other's saying, oh no, it's just psychological. In view of the uncertainties in such a situation, it would be worthwhile to go back and take a look at certain features of the historical context that might shed some light on it. So now we're off looking at all the implications for the rest of the book of these basic ideas we've talked about. Are there real spirits? Or are they just complexes? And that's an example of the questioning she'll be doing. Is there projection in religion? Is there projection in science? Are there really demons? And so on. I know when I was in training, a friend of mine, two gay guys were living together, and they each had a separate room, and one of the guys would wake up in the middle of the night with this horrible presence attacking him. And the other guy said, well, you're just a wussy. We'll change rooms. The other guy started waking up in the middle of the night, and the spirit started attacking him. So they made that the guest bedroom. And the guest that stayed in there the first time woke up in the middle of the night with this presence attacking him.
Wow.
So they asked the landlord, did anything happen in that room? And he said, oh yeah, the last tenant committed suicide in that room.
Wow.
So is there such a thing as a real spirit? Or I'm just trying to give some credence to the other side. Basically, we're working with a psychological analysis, but that paragraph is a springboard to the rest of the book that we'll be circling now around many different questions that this idea of projection touches on. I just want to make sure you got the basic ideas. I think basic ideas so far are two definitions, something in me cast out, or a disturbance in the archaic identity, and the steps of withdrawal, which we'll talk about throughout. So we'll come back to that. And probably the other really important detail is, how do we tell whether a projection is a projection or a perception? No answer, but just to know, it's a big question. Some of the other ancillary items along the way is, are there demons, or are these things purely psychological? I think they're both, personally, at least in some cases.
Gary, can we go back up on 34?
Mm-hmm.
Up close to the top. This one's down where it says, introverted and introspective people can, however, perceive events in the inner world directly without the detour of a projection onto the other. So that would be like in dreams, or would that just be perceptions that they have?
I think more what she's saying, though I totally agree, I'm not sure, that introverts, because they're so busy looking at themselves, might not need to see it outside themselves. I don't know whether that's true or not, but it's worthy of thinking about. Introverts have extroverted projections, and extroverts have introverted projections. more likely.
I did want to ask you to go back even
yes.
to 32. That whole black sheet. Say a little bit more. I mean, at one point in that big paragraph, a nice line down about.
Black sheep, the butt of all jokes.
Yeah, which is a sign that the shadows are suddenly disturbed by others taken possession by one. Can you just say more about that?
Well, it really touches on the idea of the collective unconscious, that we don't just project our personal shadow, but there is such a thing as a collective shadow. And we project that as well. And that takes a group to do. I remember being in Switzerland, and you know, the Swiss really aren't racists like we are, but they are, I don't know what the word is, nationalists. I mean, they think they're the best country in the world. In some ways, they are, but they don't like the Italians. The Italians are messy and sloppy, but they all go there for vacation. See what I mean? But the Italians are so different from the Swiss. That's where the collective projection comes in. Swiss are orderly and frugal, and the Italians are effusive and warm-hearted.
It's amazing, they're right next to each other.
And they're right next to each other, yeah.
Does that have to do also with hooks? I mean, when you see people who become the scapegoat for their own family and then just serially become scapegoats and situations.
Yeah, you learn the victim role, most definitely. The way I heard Edinger put it is you identify with the victim archetype. And that is nasty. Getting out of that one.
But you know, in work situations, it can be the group projects their collective shadow onto the to an individual. I mean, that individual becomes the natural, the automatic place for blame to be put, and you see it a lot at work, where the group has to have an excuse, an explanation for the boss, and then that person gets to be the, you know, usually one or two people get to be, because they think differently or act differently.
Right.
Or they're introverted rather than extroverted.
Right.
And
or it gets blamed on the boss, or
that's what you think.
Or sometimes the boss becomes the scapegoat.
Well, that too, yeah. But it's just, it just seems like in every group setting that I've been in and worked, there has to be a scapegoat. There has to be.
Certainly among unconscious people. Without a doubt.
Didn't they have, I don't know if this was in India or in ancient times, they would have someone called the sin eater who would take the projections of the negative, and they would treat that person like a god throughout the whole year, and then at the end of the year they sacrificed that person as an offering for their shadow.
Well, you know, the origin of the word scapegoat is really in, I mean, it's biblical. In the Old Testament, the village would heap the sins of their community onto a goat and send it out to the forest. And the original word was originally a scapegoat. And we call it the scapegoat. Yeah. In a way, it's kind of it's healthy and not healthy because it doesn't promote consciousness, but it keeps the shadow off of the group. Apropos the victim archetype, I remember when I was in grad school, I worked at a school for delinquent kids. And I could tell when one of those kids was getting ready to act out, they would suddenly start looking and talking guilty. And it occurred to me, they feel guilt first, and then they would do something to be negative so that they could carry the projection of asshole by everybody else around them. So that's why punishment doesn't work. They're already guilty. That's why they commit the crime. They already feel guilty.
Like,
and then they'd be called. Yeah.
And then they would?
Then they would be called.
They'd be called. Okay.
Yeah. You know, they felt bad. They maybe set the bathroom on fire with lighter fluid. Then they were fine.
It's like a compulsion to act that out.
I thought it was like a compulsion to be a victim.
Compulsion.
It looks like they're, well, and they were criminals, but the real dynamic was they were doing something to meet the feeling of being guilty, and in doing that, then they became a victim of their own guilt. So it's wicked. And so in the school, they didn't punish the kids. And that was really probably the best way to stop that behavior. The school made them repair the damage, but they weren't punished. They had to be responsible for harm that was done. But they weren't expelled or something like that.
And then eventually it went on.
Well, it never worked. But these were dead end kids. These were kids who were, it was the last step before jail. And I think one or two I saw one or two get better. Most of them are probably either dead or Hell's Angels. I mean, literally.
I forget now where the Jung was saying this, but it seems like so important if there's poison that gets going between two people, if you can. Stop it and say, okay, we're going to put this in this vessel between the two of us. And keep it, so, you know, out here in a third entity. That can help stop the projections and work through the conflict. But I might have made a Nietzsche somewhere. Yeah, I think it was.
Was it?
Yeah. And
if it works, sure.
That he was saying that you've got to, for the sake of mankind, stop the damn poison projecting in, put it in a vessel where it can cook, I guess, you know, but get it out in between, you know, away from both of you.
Yeah.
And I remember Barbara Hanna used to say that too, or maybe that's one of them, but. Oh, the devil got in. Let's start all over. You know, the devil got in the discussion. And just put him away and start over again.
Acknowledge it, put it away, and start.
I was just thinking of that one.
That's in a way honoring the complex.
Yeah.
And saying you have sovereignty over your own life. The complex doesn't have to drive you.
Politics can take notes.
Anything else before we go on to?
I just wonder if that could help those kids.
Oh, I don't know. They were so destructive, though.
You just can't help but wonder. I mean, why that's compulsive in one person, in one kid?
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
Is it genetic? Is there a predisposition? Some of them, you could tell they came from horrible homes, but some didn't. I mean. Normal fucked up homes, not horribly horrible homes, you know.
But didn't Yale say in some of this stuff about children that children's egos are so weak that whatever the family is projecting as a parent,
that might be an explanation.
The child picks up on that, and that if that is not broken over time with them dealing with other people, they could end up with.
Yeah, that would be when they become things projected onto them, which I think is what happens with kids. That's, at least in the pop psych literature that I know of, that is never discussed. Yeah, I don't know if you follow the dialogue in parenting, I guess. There's sort of my generation was, well, just affirm the kid and make sure you pay attention to self-esteem, and now there's a swing to the other side. Oh, that's too permissive. You really should be more authoritarian. And nobody ever talks about projections. I mean, the whole issue is just missed. I think really it isn't what you do, it's what you project onto the kid that is the strongest factor. Even animals. I think animals respond to projection.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I wanted to mention, we were talking about neurons last week. I did look on the internet to confirm that that was actually first seen in primates. And then it's seen it in birds, too. Yeah. I mean, non-human primates. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right. Chapter 2. Ta-da!
Any more complex than chapter 1, I'm in trouble.
Oh, we are just getting started. I should warn you, you've joined a group of Jungian masochists. This is peanuts compared to what we have done, isn't it? What do you think? What of religious experience is projection is the theme of this chapter. For example, I'll just give you an introduction. We now would say, well, Zeus, he's not a real god. Aphrodite, she's not a real goddess. Aphrodite is love or sensuality, and Zeus would be my powerful side, and so on. So what was once believed in, we now consider a psychological factor. And she's going to be looking at the history of religion as the process of withdrawing projections from religious experience. It raises a couple of authority problems, which we'll get to in a second. So let's go through what she does on 36. Those five stages, do I need to review them? Let me do it. She said five. I thought maybe it was six, but on page 10 to 11, I'll just review it. First, you're identical with the projection. So, in other words, I think my friend is a creep. End of story. The second stage is what she calls differentiation, where I begin to think, well, my friend doesn't always act like a creep. Wonder why I think he's a creep all the time. So a little bit of reality starts coming in, and you start doubting. The third stage is recognizing whether it is a good or bad attribute that I'm seeing in the other person. Ooh, that's something I like, or ooh, I better stay away from that. The fourth is when you recognize that what you once thought was a quality of another person is an illusion.
So he's not really a creep?
So he's not really a creep. That gets harder when the person is a creep. Mm-hmm. But I think if the other person is a creep, the illusion would be, well, they may be difficult, but I'm not so great either. You recognize that your perception of the other person was colored by your own personality, one way or the other. And then she links these next two as step five. I thought they were two different steps, but anyway. You recognize the psychic existence of what you were projecting. I am the creep. And then along with that, in her fifth stage, is a moral integration of that fact. She calls those last two step five. I kind of broke them up into step five and six. The moral integration would mean, well, I have the capacity to be an un- unlikable person, I've got to find some way to live that that doesn't conflict with my values. Now maybe my values have to change a little bit. Or let's say I realize I can be a negative person. Maybe I realize there are situations where I need to be negative against a bully, for example. And so that would be the moral integration. I use or serve that projected content in a way that is consonant with my view of life. Realizing that sometimes your view of life might have to change to accommodate that. So, now she says, let's look at the Greeks. So we're going to look at the Greeks where it's so obvious to us that once what once people thought were gods, we now see as personality attributes. Once she makes that point, she'll take this idea of interpreting and withdrawing projections from gods to Christianity. But she's first trying to give us an example where it's clear. The Greeks originally thought that the gods were living entities. That's stage one. Zeus was Zeus and Hera was Hera, and they came and they went. And the second, so that's the second paragraph, 136.
36.
The third paragraph on 36 is now the second stage of withdrawing projections from religious figures. And that is when the Greeks began to say, it's not that Poseidon or whoever are omnipotent presences which come and go. They are aspects of certain parts of nature. So Poseidon would dominate the sea life. Aphrodite would dominate the love life. Zeus would dominate contractual agreements and so on. It's beginning to be narrowed down. And the third stage is there, 1, 2, 3, 4, 4 or 5 lines up. Moral distinctions began to be made, so that Poseidon is in the Odyssey negative. He's trouble, and so on. Now, that is preparatory to the fourth stage. I have all my notes. In the fourth stage, one says those things don't exist.
This is what the Greeks say?
Yeah. She's taking the pattern of withdrawing projections and just showing how the Greeks went through it.
They said the gods don't exist.
That when rational philosophy started in Greece, that rational philosophy devalued the existence of gods. Reason replaced these divinities. That's the top of 37. Now, what is so important here is how in the process of withdrawing projections at the fourth stage, the objective existence of what was projected is denied. And reason takes its place.
in this particular case?
No, in all cases.
When the objective is existence is denied.
Yeah, right. Well, there are gods. You know, they're superstitions. That's what the Greek rational philosophers would say. And they constructed, at least in their mind, a scientific view of the world, of forces and processes that could be explained by reason, not by magic or superstition. In a way, that's an advance, because it breaks superstition and magical thinking. And it puts within our control what once we felt to be victims of, or objects of. So it's a growth in human power, human potency, in the best sense. But what is lost is the symbolic meaning of what was projected. That comes in the fifth stage, where we would say, well, but Zeus is part of the human personality. Aphrodite is part of the human personality. Poseidon is part of the human personality. So first there is belief in the god, then there is putting reason in the place of the god, and reason is what determines life. And later only comes the realization that what was projected wasn't false. It was just true on the wrong level. Does that make sense? So what she's really going to be focusing on in this chapter is a step between 4 and 5. Doubting the literal interpretation and putting in its place eventually a symbolic interpretation of the experience. So, on 38, she then says, the fifth stage is recognizing that these things that were once thought to be real are real, but on a different level. They are psychic qualities and states in human beings. So eventually, on page 39, she gives a reference to a Stoic philosopher, Zeno, who would say the gods are parts of the human experience, symbols of the human experience. Once they were taken literally, then they were denied. Then they are taken symbolically.
And then we lost all that, right?
Well, the loss that she wants to direct our attention to is the loss when you say it doesn't exist. Now, the reason she started out with the Greeks is it's so obvious to us. But... But let's suppose, I'm jumping way ahead, the medieval view that there are little spirits in the material world. Well, we know there aren't. But what about synchronicity?
And
if you're Irish, leprechauns.
Who doesn't believe in
that? This is going to be a hard lesson to get across.
It's like the quote from this modern Irish woman, somebody talks to her and she goes, you know, do you believe in leprechauns? He says, well, no, but they do exist, you know.
Here at the bottom of page 38, she talks about they restore in part the first stage of archaic identity alongside the emergence of the fifth stage.
Yes. Where is that?
It's on the bottom of page 38.
Yeah.
So you have, once you identify something as symbolic, start a new myth. Is that correct?
Yeah, let's look. Okay, I just want to make sure you got the basic idea, because then we'll go a step further.
I'm jumping ahead.
No, you're not. You're right on target. Are you okay with the steps?
Yeah, I guess I just wonder, though, why there's an eeks who believe it's not, it doesn't really exist. I mean, that seems like that's part of the necessary part of the process, but I just wondered why.
Well, because it's superstition. And as far as the let's put it this way. The problem with superstition and magic is you don't have control over it. Mm-hmm. So it's the record of consciousness trying to get control of human experience. Mm-hmm. And it gets control of human experience by saying sacred experience doesn't exist. But it kills the psychological truth of sacred experience, which is reestablished only in the fifth stage. You know, I don't think I have. I remember once talking to an English woman about Jung and sort of describing archetypes and things. Well, that's just like the superstition my grandfather believed. See, all that world had to be denied and reason was put in its place. That is a step in the withdrawal projections. And it's just a natural step. If reason wants to assert itself. And that's about as far as the general mind is willing to go. Jung, she's essentially saying, says, but what were you projecting onto those experiences? And what you were projecting onto those gods or those sprites was a part of your own personality. So that goes back to the original belief in the thing, but replaces a symbolic understanding of it with replaces a literal understanding of it with a symbolic understanding of it. That's what they mean by, that's what she means by the first stage archaic identity. That what the projection saw as literally true is true, but it is not literally true, it's symbolically true. You okay with that? So, well, then we're going to make it a little more complicated. Okay, let's look at that last sentence on 38. Three lines up from the bottom. The statement of the new truth reveals the previous conceptions as projections. Okay, does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And tries to draw them into the psychic inner world. That's the fifth stage. Fourth stage would be saying their projections. Fifth stage would be seeing what you projected onto them is a part of your own personality, which you made metaphysical in a religious projection. Now, and at the same time, it announces a new myth, which now passes for the finally discovered absolute truth. Now, There are worlds in that sentence.
This is the transformation of God image.
This is the transformation of the God image. Now, she's doing it with the Greeks. That's not so hard for us to stomach. But if you apply it, which she will do, and I'm going to summarize it, and then we'll pick up with it next time. We are in such a period now where intelligent people say God doesn't exist. That is putting reason in the place of God. That says that God had been a projection. But that is only the fourth stage. The fifth stage says, what of my own psyche have I been projecting onto God? And how do I establish a relationship to it? This is why Jung talks about the God image instead of God. Does this make sense? Sure? Fellow sure? Okay. Now, the kicker here is, once you have done that, a new myth can emerge, which you will literally believe in, and eventually integrate. So that the evolution of consciousness occurs by doubting the current religious system. Some people will stop there. For example, the existentialists. Jung says, okay, you can doubt the literal existence, but you have to then ask yourself, what of your own psyche, what of the human psyche, had been projected onto that understanding of God? So he's just taking what we've learned about people and put it into religion. That means to get out of that projection onto God, you've got to find the God within. And as soon as you do, a new religious myth will be born, which may last for hundreds of years, until somebody says, that doesn't make sense anymore. So what we'll be doing is seeing this process that she talked about with the Greeks, that happened. Greeks started doubting the existence of their pantheon. Then there was a new revelation of Christianity. We are now in the same position with Christianity as the Greeks were with their gods. Doubting them. Integrating them. And I think it's a statement of faith, and just as Christianity followed the integration of the Greek pantheon, a new religion will follow the integration of the Christian pantheon.
Do you consider Judaism part of the Christian?
I would say Judeo-Christian. I would say every religion, honestly. I don't know about Buddhism, but certainly Islam. I don't know about Hinduism either, but certainly Islam and Christianity. I mean, they are the mosaic. Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, for sure.
Abrahamic.
Sorry?
Abrahamic religion?
Abrahamic, yeah. Tradition. What did I say? Anyway, the Abrahamic traditions, right. They all go back to Abraham. Definitely. And I think that's part of the reason of our battle with Islam. Both our gods are dying.
But they're all one god as opposed to
Buddhist. But remember now, this is what's so hard to make the shift. When we say God is dying, we mean our projection onto God is dying. Just like when I project onto another individual, they may have those qualities. When I say God is a projection, I don't, and Jung doesn't, mean that God is nothing but a projection. but that my knowledge of God is a projection onto God. Well, I'll spend more time on this next week. I brought along, I don't want to get into it today. We'll just get confused, but we'll go through this book a little bit next time. Where Jung, it's called The New God Image.
Oh, yeah.
Jung's last theological thoughts are in his second volume of letters. And I've tried to read them, and they're just ghastly. Ettinger wonderfully has gone through those letters and extracted the main theological points out of them. That's what this book is. So, since this book is about religious projection, we spent a little bit of time on Jung's own words about how he understands religious projections. Because people will think, well, Jung is psychologizing God. And he's not. He's simply saying, I'm psychologizing the experience of God. And we need to do that now because it's time to integrate our old understanding of God, not to show that God doesn't exist. See, that would be the fourth stage. But to find what we projected onto God in ourselves, that would be the fifth stage. And that will lay the foundation of a new revelation. So that we're at the juncture of the death of Christianity, I would say the death of Islam. That's why the fundamentalists of Islam and the fundamentalists of Christianity are holding on to it so tightly. As preparation for a new revelation. Perhaps even one in which the differences are resolved. This would take about 500 years, Jung thought. But, as I said, we're taking this idea of projection and we're applying it to a much vaster realm than just personal experience. Now we're applying it to religious experience. Yeah.
Well, I don't want to, but I was just sometimes feeling in some discussions I have outside this class that that whole idea of reason is almost stage one. You know what I mean? They've identified with reason almost as if it were the superstition of the thing. They have so much belief in reason that
That's
they actually distort what could other, because there's not always one perception.
Absolutely. Yeah. But that's, for her, the nature of that fourth stage, that reason is deified.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the advantage, you know, the advantage is it gives us control over superstitions. You know, like the, you're talking about that movie where a scapegoat is found in a woman. Well, that's the witch hunts. Mm-hmm. So the making reason God is an attempt to overcome the destructiveness of witch hunts, for example. You know, I have a friend who, I may have mentioned, he's a fellow colleague in Canada who's Australian and has made friends with some of the Aborigines in the Outback, and every couple of years goes back to Australia and camps out with him for a summer. And he said one summer he was there and one of the women in the tribe woke up sick. And the witch doctor said, well, Joe Smith from tribe 7 miles away has put a hex on her. So that night the guys went over and clubbed Joe Smith to death. Reason is an attempt to stop that kind of stuff. It has the gain in making behavior more rational at some moments, but at a huge expense of what's in the psyche. So what we'll be doing now in the rest of the chapter is looking at these stages in Christianity and what that means for our time, because we are in a position of seeing the death of God, the danger of putting reason in the place of that, the necessity of finding the inner God so that a new revelation can occur, and that that is the nature of the religious process. We project, we withdraw, we find an inner equivalence, and that sets the stage for a new revelation. And these occur in 500-year cycles. But as I said, she's taking projection now and just applying it to first religion, then science, and then so on.
Gary, do humans then have some kind of instinctual need for a God image that we don't understand what purpose that serves, or, I mean, didn't Jung say that we also have a religious instinct?
Yeah. I think it's, you know, Jung, well, just, let me just read you one thing here real quick. It sounds like I can read you. I'll take it up too much time. He's talking about religious experiences. These experiences contain a real mystery, but the statements about them don't. He's a theist. Mm-hmm. That's why. And for him, that's simply the nature of reality. The problem is that we can never know divinity, and what we create are psychological approximations of our experience. And that we can apply psychology to. But the reason we have to do this is we live in a world with God. Light talk for a Saturday morning. Well, I don't know if we'll get through. I had you read till the end of religion, huh? I don't think we'll get through more than that next time. I want to spend some time reading to you from the New God Image to set the stage. So we have meeting in 2 weeks, and then that's it for the year. And I'll have the schedule ready for the fall. I'll give it to you next time. I haven't got around to it.
So chapter 2.
So I think if we even get through with it early, we'll just kick back and talk. It's what we've done. So you read for 2 for today. There's really nothing more to read. Okay, thank you for hanging in there. Not easy, but hopefully you enjoy it.